Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Law with June Grosso from Bloomberg Radio.
The National Football League is being investigated by California and New York over allegations that it fostered discrimination and harassment in the workplace. The Attorneys General of New York and California announced the joint probe of the NFL's workplace practices and culture and have issued subpoenas to the league to gather information and determine whether it flouted federal and state pay equity laws and anti-discrimination laws. Here's California AG Rob Bonta.
Employees, past and present, continue to make allegations of discrimination. And from where we stand, they have not been addressed. And so we're going to dig in and see. We're going to heavily scrutinize the NFL's practices, procedures, and work environment. We're going to look closely and turn all the stones and see what's there.
An NFL spokesperson said the organization takes the issue seriously and will fully cooperate with the attorneys general, but that the allegations are, quote, entirely inconsistent with the NFL's value and practices. My guest is Martin Edel, co-chair of the sports law practice at Gulston Storrs. The NFL obviously has faced investigations before, but this investigation appears to be the first involving workplace violations in the league's corporate office. Explain why the attorneys general decided to take this step.
As best as I can divine, and you know, it's hard to put myself in the head of both Letitia James and her California counterpart, we have a group of employees, more than 30, who complained last year about a hostile work environment in the NFL. You have the NFL also employing over 37% of its employees are women, 30% are people of color. With those kind of numbers, it's incumbent, it seems to me, on the attorneys general of states in which the NFL has offices, namely California and New York, to take very seriously complaints about a hostile work environment, harassment, you know, male cultures of dominance, that frankly ought not to exist anymore, but unfortunately still do. So I think they're looking into what's going on there based on the number of allegations, and it's because it's more than one. We've had, as I mentioned, 30 women last year filed allegations of a hostile work environment and discrimination against the NFL. This year you have a couple of other people filing, women in particular, but also people of color filing complaints about hostile work environments and discrimination against the NFL. And I think the attorneys general of New York and California are taking very seriously their obligation to investigate.
Will the attorneys general be able to get further than the women can in their lawsuits with discovery?
Well, what we do know, I think the answer is they can get to the root. If there is a problem, they can get to the root of it more quickly than in a civil lawsuit, because this would be either a civil or a criminal investigation, and the states have enormous powers in terms of subpoenas and investigative powers that would simply drag on for a much longer time than any civil lawsuit.
There have been lawsuits filed by former employees, congressional hearings last year into the workplace practices of the Washington Commanders, and that 2022 New York Times article reporting on allegations of gender discrimination by more than 30 former female NFL employees. So this is nothing new. The NFL has been on notice about this for a long time.
Unfortunately, this is the most recent spat of complaints are coming on the heels of other complaints about a hostile work environment and discrimination. You know, we've seen them in the media with Ray Rice and his then partner, subsequently his wife, who he beat up in an elevator in New Jersey. And you may recall that the commissioner initially handed him a slap on the wrist, and then the outcry was sufficiently large that the commissioner looked back into it again and handed out a much more severe punishment. But that wasn't the only incident. We have Flores, who filed his lawsuit. He was a coach with Miami who didn't get head coaching positions, although he was eminently qualified. And he filed a discrimination lawsuit in February of 2022, and that's winding its way through the Southern District Court. And they're in discovery at this point in that lawsuit. And more recently, as you point out, we have Dan Snyder and the Commanders, where it was reputed that he fostered a hostile work environment, did things that people shouldn't be doing at ever, but certainly not in a heightened sensitivity environment that we currently exist. And there were reports about that that went to Congress. Ultimately, the NFL, I think it's fair to say, forced Snyder out of his ownership position, although he wasn't hurting for it because he sold the ownership position for an enormous sum. But yes, there are more and more incidents. It's coming out in sports and particularly in the NFL, although the other leagues are not immune from claims of hostile work environment and discrimination.
I mean, how do you prove a hostile work environment?
Well, it has to be more than he said, she said. So you need to have a series of comments or actions that would make an employee feel threatened in his or her current environment. And you have to have, in this case, it would be the NFL not taking sufficiently serious the allegations, or even if they did take the allegations sufficiently seriously, not then implementing a corrective plan for it. All of which are very difficult to do, but nonetheless are required by the law.
Roger Goodell, NFL commissioner, said that workplace misconduct is thoroughly investigated at the NFL and retaliation against complainants is prohibited. The league has put more effort into diversifying its hiring and has mandatory anti-racism training and an anonymous hotline called Protect the Shield for employees' concerns. Is there a way to completely rid the NFL of any of these claims?
Well, the answer is you can never eliminate entirely a hostile work environment because there are always bad actors out there, people who may feel entitled and just disregard what's there. But the NFL is starting down the right path. This may be late in the game, although it's better than not having done anything, but taking allegations seriously, investigating them thoroughly, because they have a media presence. They're wrong to start with if they're accurate. And also they have a negative media impact. And no matter what anybody says, the NFL is not simply a male domain. There are lots of women who watch NFL games, and you don't want to alienate your audiences. And the more complaints that come down, the greater the risk of alienating your audiences, alienating your sponsors, and alienating your media hosts, which would redound to negative impacts on profitability.
What other sports have similar complaints lodged against them?
I don't think any other sport, which I'm aware currently, has quite the same problem that the NFL has, because you don't have quite the same number of people complaining. Are there people complaining? Sure. We had the incident with the Phoenix Suns in the fall this year with Robert Sarver, who a number of employees complained had created a hostile working environment, discriminated against women. And unlike the NFL, the NBA investigated the claims. It was very public in its report, in making its report public, and in taking action to try to strip Mr. Sarver of his ownership interest. And ultimately, the Phoenix Suns were sold. That didn't take a year or 2 years. It took a couple of months, which is why I think the NFL seems to be new to what it's doing here and is perhaps a lot slower than an entity like the NBA.
Let's take an abrupt turn to wrestling. The question, is pro wrestling a sport or entertainment? And why does that matter? Because it complicates whether betting should be permitted. WWE is pushing states to legalize gambling on its matches. But should regulators allow people to bet their real money on choreographed events where the winners and losers are predetermined? I know nothing about wrestling, Marty, so educate me.
So WWE, Worldwide Wrestling, has taken the position in the past that it is a form of entertainment, not athletic sport, which is based on performance. That would sort of lead you to the conclusion, I don't want to use the term fake, but the outcomes may be predetermined. If that's the case, then WWE would not generally fit within the framework of most states' betting laws. States that permit betting generally have it based on, one, a sport, and two, where the outcome is not predetermined but is based on performance. WWE does not seem to qualify under either count, and I think that's why we see a lot of pushback there.
Well, courts in Connecticut, Nebraska, New York, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Tennessee have issued conflicting decisions on whether pro wrestling is a sport, entertainment activity, or a hybrid.
There's one other thing there, which is WWE is pointing out, well, you know, betting is now allowed on the outcome of the Oscars, and that is not a sport. It's predetermined because the actors who are on stage read the winner, which has been determined previously, but it's different, it seems to me at least, than WWE because it has been based on performance, namely people are voting for who they think is best actor, best actress, best film writer, best movie, etc. And that is a performance base, and there are very few people who know the outcome. You know, it's those accountants who come up on stage afterward. But WWE, the whole thing is we're a form of entertainment. We appeal to people because they can see body slams, hair pulling, and the like, all of which is an art form, not based on any real performance. So I think WWE will have a tough time convincing state regulatory authorities that they should qualify for legal sports betting.
I won't be waiting anxiously for the result on this. Thanks so much, Marty. That's Martin Edel, co-chair of the sports law practice at Goulston Stores.
What could you do if your data was working for you and not against you? With Bloomberg delivering enterprise data directly to your systems, you get easy access to the details you want, optimized for higher-level analysis, and financial data experts committed to helping you maximize your every move. Our data is made for more, so you can show the world what you're made of. Visit Bloomberg.com/enterprise data to learn more.
Whistleblowers across various industries potentially face a heightened standard for proving retaliation now that the Supreme Court is taking on the case of a former UBS bond strategist. The Second Circuit overturned a $1.7 million jury verdict against UBS after finding that the Sarbanes-Oxley Act required former employee Trevor Murray to show the bank fired him with retaliatory intent. Joining me is an expert in business law, Eric Talley, a professor at Columbia Law School. Eric, tell us about the case itself.
Yeah, this is a case that goes back to the financial crisis, and this was an employee of UBS who, you know, basically reported out irregularities having to do with the way that various types of collateralized claims and mortgage-backed securities were working inside the bank. And after sort of making these reports, you know, a couple months after this gentleman was terminated, and he filed suit claiming that he was terminated in retaliation for exposing what he believed to be fraudulent practices.
He won $1.7 million in a jury verdict. And then what happened at the Second Circuit?
Well, it was a federal claim, and so the case comes up through the Southern District of New York, and then it goes to the Second Circuit on appeal from UBS. that had claimed that they really should have, you know, won in a directed verdict right away. That was denied by the trial court, so they brought it up to the Second Circuit. And the Second Circuit ended up hearing the case and then issuing opinion late last year that I think surprised many people, saying that the trial court made a problematic error by misinstructing the jury on how they should think about these types of retaliation claims, and in particular, thinking about, you know, how do you prove that you were terminated in retaliation for whistleblowing or a protected report under the whistleblowing statute. The trial court had basically said to the jury that you could find that the employee was wrongfully terminated in violation of the whistleblower retaliation rule if the act of blowing the whistle, if the protected report, was a contributing factor to why the person ended up being terminated. And the Second Circuit said that's not enough. That in fact, there has to be specific intent to terminate. It can't just be one of the many contributing factors. The whistleblowing activity has to be the predominant factor. It has to be the main reason why the employer gave, you know, the pink slip to the employee, not just one of a litany of reasons, each of which is carrying a little bit of a load. And so the Second Circuit basically had held that the trial court had made it too easy to win this case by basically, you know, telling the jury that, you know, the whistleblowing activity really just needs to be one of several contributing factors that led up to the termination.
And the Second Circuit is an outlier from other circuits who've addressed this issue?
That's one of the interesting things about this, is that the Second Circuit really did kind of expose itself as being, you know, very much on the outs compared to other circuits. That's one of the main reasons why the Supreme Court will take up a case like this. But as far as I can tell, at least four other major circuits, the 10th Circuit, the 9th Circuit, the 5th Circuit, and the 4th Circuit, have all held that the trial court actually did it right. That the way that the trial court's supposed to instruct the jury is just to ask whether a substantial factor of the termination was the whistleblowing activity. And so when the Second Circuit decided it was going to sort of up the ante to win one of these cases, it also put itself out of step with several other circuits that it had the opportunity to opine on this same issue as it pertains to the SEC whistleblower rule.
Do you think the Second Circuit did that because, from what I understand, the Sarbanes-Oxley Act punishes employers who retaliate because of an employee's protected activity? So they were looking at the statute?
That's usually the first line of analysis when you're trying to analyze the statute, is to ask, well, is there a plain meaning associated with the words of the statute? And you're exactly right. That's what they did. They said the relevant section here said that the employer can't discharge, demote, suspend, threaten, or harass, or in any other manner discriminate against an employee because of whistleblowing activity, which the Second Circuit read to mean that there's got to be a specific intent to do it predominantly on this basis, as opposed to that being just a contributing factor. You know, I think that reasonable minds can differ as to what the term because of means, and the Second Circuit tried to put a little bit of heft behind that conclusion, throwing out some dictionary definitions and then, you know, laying some analogies to other areas of whistleblower law where the Second Circuit has similarly defined the requisite showing for the employee to be one related to a specific intent. But, you know, other courts have interpreted some of the same other whistleblower provisions to be different. So it really does, you know, give rise to this disagreement amongst the various circuit court systems as it pertains to national law. And as a result, it really is kind of a prime thing for the Supreme Court to take up. It's probably even more momentous that this came out of the Second Circuit, where we have a lot of whistleblower cases dealing with the securities industry. And therefore, this, you know, particular circuit to be out of step with the others is probably something that would be much more difficult to sustain over time.
So do you think that the Supreme Court took the case because it wants to overturn the Second Circuit and put it in line with the other circuits?
Well, it's possible. The fact of the matter is, no matter what the Supreme Court ends up doing here, it's going to change law in some circuit. And in various other circuits have actually just gone the other way here. So, you know, there probably is a little bit of benefit to harmonizing across these different circuits. But even by the same token, there are probably 24 different federal whistleblowing statutes out there. And there's going to be another question about whether for this particular application, the court ends up embracing something that is consistent, inconsistent, or unclear as it compares to some of these other whistleblower statutes. Some of the amicus briefs that have been submitted to the court, you know, are, you know, trying to persuade the court that the contributing factor approach is more consistent with a lot of other whistleblower statutes out there. And we will see whether the court agrees with that.
How has the court treated whistleblowers before? I mean, I know this court is usually attuned to business interests.
Well, the whistleblower retaliation part of the securities laws has been probably less studied and analyzed by our federal courts than another interrelated part that came a little bit later, which is after the financial crisis, another amendment to our securities laws came into place that would give whistleblowers the ability to claim a bounty if they blew the whistle on their employer and the SEC ended up extracting a settlement from the employer. The whistleblowing employee could, in principle, be eligible to get between 10% and 30% of the amount of the fines or disgorgement. And so there's sort of two things going on at the same time. The retaliation protection is really about trying to make sure that the employee is not terminated, quote unquote, because of the whistleblowing activity. But whistleblowers also in the securities context often have another fish to fry as well, which is their potential eligibility to get a bounty under this kind of sister section of the statute. And there, the courts actually have been pretty active. Just last year, there was a holding in this area. It seems to be pretty clear that now if you were going to be a whistleblower and try to claim the bounty, you're going to have to make sure that you make that report directly to the SEC. You can't make it to, you know, someone else internally. And that's kind of has caused a lot more sort of formalistic type of reporting. Another recent case also said, hey, listen, if you make this report to the SEC, but then some other agency and government pursues the claim and they win an award, you're not eligible for the bounty. And so there's been an awful lot of activity going on about when and under what circumstances someone can take a piece of the action from what happens through a whistleblowing report. And so in some ways, you know, what happens here, I think, probably needs to be sort of evaluated side by side with what's happening in whistleblowing. I will note that just within, you know, the last couple of weeks, a record whistleblower award or bounty award of almost $300 million was doled out to a whistleblowing employee. So this can be relatively lucrative, you know, to claim the bounty, regardless of whether you are also trying to claim a retaliation award.
That award of $279 million for the SEC whistleblower was stunning. The chief of the SEC's Office of the Whistleblower said the whistleblower's sustained assistance, including multiple interviews and written submissions, was critical to the success of these actions. So a few interviews and submissions, I mean, doesn't that seem out of whack? $279 million?
It is a fairly significant chunk. And so one has to wonder, you know, how these twin whistleblower rules operate side by side together. One would guess that, you know, to the extent that the courts are making it harder to win on retaliation claims, then, you know, employee might be riding with more of their chips on the whistleblower claim. The vast majority of whistleblower claims are not in that order of magnitude, but it is not unusual to see whistleblower awards that are in the low hundreds of millions of dollars. This happens to have set the newest record, though I will note that, you know, in an inflationary period, mm-hmm. This is exactly what you expect, right?
So that's a lot of inflation to me.
It sounds like a lot of inflation to me as well. And this area, at least within securities law, has really only been around for about 12 years. So we're still kind of learning how these various pieces of the puzzle operate in conjunction with one another. You know, the other part of this is trying to just get a sense of where whistleblowers kind of live in the overall pantheon of the characters that play roles in the regulatory state. One of the reasons why the Second Circuit's opinion in this particular UBS case may be pretty momentous is that there's a lore about whistleblowers that they're the sort of the Mother Teresa Boy Scout type employees who happen one day at work to see something that they think is suspect or wrong or violating of a statute or even criminal, and they report it out. And I have no doubt that many whistleblowers have that sort of, I don't know, character sketch about them. But, you know, it's also the case that sometimes whistleblowers will emerge from larger settings that are more complex, in which there's already been conflict. And maybe this person also feels like, you know, they are under-recognized or other people are over-recognized or some other strategic decision didn't go in their direction, but they also know some of this information. And, you know, I have no idea what the empirical composition of whistleblowers are, but to the extent that it's made up of folks that, you know, already have some backstory and there's some friction inside the organization, one would guess that it's going to be harder than to claim that, oh, I was terminated for the predominant reason of my whistleblowing activity as opposed to some of these other conflicts that I may have been involved with in the organization itself. So this could really end up moving the needle, at least on the retaliation claims. It doesn't seem to bear on the whistleblower bounty claims in the securities industry. However, those seem to operate effectively under different standards.
The whistleblower bounty claims, is there any transparency there? Because I haven't seen anything about, you know, what this case was about that had the largest whistleblower settlement.
There is an entire office at the SEC that ends up sort of processing these claims. The content of what the employee has provided them as opposed to things that they developed on their own is sometimes obscured in the final sort of, you know, statement of settlements that you see that are publicly available. It generally appears to be the case, though, the SEC is willing to be more generous the more that they're having to depend on the underlying information of the employee, to the extent that there are many sources of information or maybe many employees that are simultaneously trying to make those reports. It's harder to score one of these larger bounties. But you can, you know, if you were to sort of pick through the statement of these settlements when they are issued by the SEC, sometimes with a little bit of a delay, you can kind of get a sense of what role the whistleblower played in the process as well.
Going back to the retaliation claims, some lawyers have said that requiring proof of retaliatory intent would make it virtually impossible for whistleblowers to pursue Sarbanes-Oxley retaliation claims. Do you agree with that?
There are parts of that that I'm not so sure about, but there is part of that claim that definitely has a kernel of truth. First thing to note is that when you are making a retaliation claim under the Sarbanes-Oxley whistleblower provisions, you are actually subjected to one of the more permissive burdens of proof, so-called preponderance of the evidence burden of proof, which is the mildest of all of them that we have. And in contrast, when the employer is trying to disprove the claim, they actually have an asymmetric burden. They have a clear and convincing evidence burden. And that's not in question in any of these cases, that you know, relatively accommodating preponderant test is still going to be applicable to all whistleblower claims. So I think we just have to put this in proper context. On the other hand, you know, the world is complex. And when people make decisions and when organizations make decisions, it can often come from a bunch of different sources, right? There can be many things that end up sort of, you know, many straws that break the camel's back, and not one of them is the biggest straw in the pile. And that can be a big problem for someone who's making a retaliation claim if, in fact, there are four, five, six, a dozen different reasons that the employer is citing for why the termination took place. It's now become much more challenging to demonstrate that the whistleblowing activity was, in fact, the predominant factor, and therefore there was specific intent to retaliate. You know, if you're a strategic employer as well, then it's likely that, you know, when you make a decision to terminate someone in the wake of a whistleblower complaint, you're not just going to put the whistleblower complaint in there. You're going to list six, seven, or eight other reasons why you were terminated that person. And that's just going to make it much harder for the employee to say, okay, we're going to now have to weed through all those reasons and to try to give the jury or the judge reasons to doubt the other six or seven, leaving just the whistleblower complaint on the horizon. Now, it sometimes does help if you've documented the claim that you are making, and in fact, the way that the bounty system has kind of evolved has kind of created greater incentives to document when and under what circumstances and exactly to whom you were making these whistleblowing reports. And that can actually help in putting together a retaliation claim later on. But it definitely is going to make it harder if, in fact, the Supreme Court holds that you have to demonstrate that retaliation was kind of the principal reason behind the termination.
Yeah, and in this case, UBS maintained that the whistleblower was never a whistleblower and instead was fired as part of a broader staff reduction. So if the Supreme Court rules in favor of UBS, could that affect other whistleblower statutes? Because two lawmakers who lead the Senate Whistleblower Protection Caucus identified more than a dozen federal whistleblower protection statutes that have virtually identical legal burdens. So would a Supreme Court ruling here affect that?
It seems like it might. And absolutely, one of the amicus briefs notes that the Sarbanes-Oxley model itself was fashioned after pre-existing models in which, at least according to the folks submitting this amicus brief, it was drafted specifically to sort of mimic their structure and to mimic the contributing factor approach rather than the specific intent approach. And so if the Supreme Court were to come back and say, well, we're going to agree with the Second Circuit, then it may, in theory, put into play, a bunch of these other whistleblower statutes and whether and to what extent they similarly require a showing of specific intent. Now, I will note that the Second Circuit, most of its analysis, and certainly the beginning part of its analysis, is very, very wedded to the precise textual structure of the retaliation provision in Sarbanes-Oxley. So that may provide at least a little wiggle room, even if the Supreme Court were to say, we're going to agree with the Second Circuit, but that doesn't necessarily mean that every other whistleblower retaliation statute out there is in play as well, unless and to the extent to which they mimic exactly the same sort of grammatical structure.
Thanks for being on the show, Eric. That's Professor Eric Talley of Columbia Law School. And that's it for this edition of the Bloomberg Law Show. Remember, you can always get the latest legal news on our Bloomberg Law podcast. You can find them on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at www.bloomberg.com/podcast/law. And remember to tune into the Bloomberg Law Show every weeknight at 10 p.m. Wall Street time. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.